As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Hello and welcome to the Metrospective presented by Topps. Check out Topps Project 70, celebrating 70 years of Topps baseball cards. I'm Ted Berg. The Athletics Mets beat writer Tim Britton is still on vacation. He will be back next week to talk all about the ups and downs of the Mets season since we've last heard from him. But today, a little something different. Rustin Dodd, whom you might remember filling in for Tim on the Mets beat this week and on the show last week, caught up with Nick Davis, who is the filmmaker for ESPN's upcoming 30 for 30 about the 1986 Mets, a team that obviously has a huge place in Mets history, probably the biggest place in Mets history. It's called Once Upon a Time in Queens. It is a great chat. It's a really interesting talk about making this project. So I'm going to turn it over to Rustin.
Okay, Nick Davis, thank you so much for joining us. I wanted to start here. So very quickly, where were you in 1986 and what was your relationship to the 1986 Mets?
Well, I am a huge lifelong Mets fan and I was 21 years old in college in 1986. It was the culmination of a, you know, childhood dream to see the Mets finally winning a World Series. I was four in 1969 and like to sort of pretend I can remember that victory, but I didn't really remember. And watching this team come into the 80s and emerge from the ashes of the 70s when they were in the toilet and the city was in the toilet and watching the team and the city come back in the 80s was so thrilling. And the formation of that particular team and the characters and the personalities on that team was so exhilarating as a fan in the mid 80s that it, in a way, it really is the culmination of a lifelong dream to be able to tell this story on film.
Yeah. Where can you remember where you were for game six?
I can. I am a very superstitious Mets fan, as many of us are. And I never liked to interrupt what I was doing to watch a game. And I was, I had auditioned for a college play and I was in a play Saturday night. And when the game happened, I had actually snuck my roommate's Watchman, which was, this dates me, but it was, 1986 dates me, but it was an old, you know, television with a really long kind of, it was like a flashlight with a television at the end of it. And I'd snuck it onto the stage. I was playing an anchorman and I had very few lines, but I just set up the Watchman on the table that they'd given me and I wrapped it in a jacket and it just looked like a piece of the set. And so I was watching the game out of the corner of my eye the whole night. And then I couldn't watch the actual 10th inning until the play was actually over and the play ended and I got back to the TV and it was 5-4. The Mets had scored their first run back. And so I got to see Mookie's at bat while I was standing, you know, in the theater, surrounded by other fans who were just watching my roommate's little watchman. And it was an amazing, amazing moment.
Yeah. So the documentary, you know, obviously places the Mets in a very specific time in New York, you know, this team coming together in the early 80s. And I'm just curious, how do you think the story of the Mets in the 1980s, kind of their rise, fits into kind of the larger story of New York?
Well, as somebody says in the documentary, Joe Petruccio, who is an artist who also worked for Della Famina, the advertising agency that came up with the Magic is Back slogan, as he says, like, you know, as the city came back, the Mets came back. And not that the Mets had anything to do with it, but it did sort of feel like it. The city was recovering from the, you know, Ford to City drop dead and the blackout of 77. The city was recovering and you know, Wall Street was recovering and the Bulls were running rampant. And there was a sense of wildness that was coming into the city that the Mets perfectly captured and perfectly expressed as they got one star after another, so that by 85, they had these four tent poles, Gooden, Strawberry, Hernandez, Carter, all on one team. And it was so exhilarating and thrilling and also dangerous. There was definitely a feeling of danger in the city and a feeling of danger about the 1986 Mets. We all knew it at the time. I mean, fans knew they were partying hard and you would hear whispers and stuff. And then, you know, four of them get arrested in the middle of the season at a brawl at a nightclub in Houston. And so you just felt like, well, at any minute, the wheels could come off. But somehow they didn't.
Yeah, you mentioned some of those characters. Obviously, Mets fans get a lot of Keith Hernandez each night on the broadcast, and he's very entertaining in the film. And there's a moment in the film where Lenny Dykstra uses the word surreal. I don't want to spoil it, but then he proceeds to spell it out, S-U-R-R-E-A-L, and explain what it means, which I really enjoyed. I'm curious, were you present for all of these interviews with the players and the characters from the 86 Mets, and did any of them surprise you, or what was you know, any in their openness?
I think I was surprised by their openness. I was present for all the interviews, well, except that many of them were in COVID, so during the pandemic, where we had to switch to remote interviews. So for Lenny Dykstra, for example, he was in Los Angeles. I was in New York. I was in my office, and I was Zooming in with him. They placed the laptop next to the camera, so it looks like he's looking at an interviewer who is just off to the side of the lens, but that's me on a laptop. They all impressed me with their openness and their willingness to tell the story. And as I've thought about it, I think it's just a function of time. I think you get up into your, you know, late 50s, early 60s, and you just don't care anymore. You're not trying to protect your reputation. You're not trying to sort of preserve some image of yourself. You just want people to know the real story. And, you know, to a man, they really want to have the story told in its complete form. I think when I first approached them, some of them were a little reluctant. They feel like, oh, not this again. It's going to be so negative. And, you know, Daryl and Doc and Daryl and Doc and Doc and Daryl and the whole thing, not the film Daryl and Doc, but just like enough with all the misery. And I was like, no. I'm telling the complete story that begins in the mid 70s with the bottoming out of the city and the team. And the first hour, the first episode is the coming together of that team, the rise of that team, and the piece by piece, you know, falling into place of the whole team, you know, as Doubleday buys the team and he hires Frank Cashin and gives him the authority to make the right baseball moves and gives him the resources. And, you know, it's I've said this, and, you know, it's a metaphor that when I was talking to my wife about this, long before we had even sold the series to anybody, I was telling her how it was just like so great. And it was great at the time to feel these characters join the team one after the other. She said, oh, it's a heist movie. And it's true. I came to think of it that way, that it's like, okay, you need a safe cracker, Lenny Dykstra. You need a cat burglar, Daryl Strawberry. You need a getaway driver. You need all of these pieces in order to make the whole thing work. So that by 86, as Wally Backman says in the film, they all just fit together like a glove. The chemistry on that team was just off the charts, and their desire to win was off the charts. And as a baseball fan, that really surprised me, because I sort of felt like, well, don't all teams want to win? And they all said, no, they've been on a lot of teams where it's not really about winning. It's about, you know, doing your best and padding your own statistics. Ojeda said, you go 3-for-4 and we lose. If you're smiling, somebody's going to punch you in the face on the 86 Mets. Like, it's about winning at all costs. And that is, and that was the 80s in New York City too. You know, we talked to Oliver Stone, who wrote the line, "Greed is good," about 1986 New York City. In New York City is where he wrote that line. And that was the spirit of the time that I wanted the film to express.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
You mentioned this is the full story of, and it's told in, you know, four episodes, almost 4 hours. Was that the plan going into it? Did you feel like this would be that sort of a wide of a scope and, you know, four episodes to tell this whole story?
Yeah. I mean, when I first conceived of it, I thought, I just thought, oh, baseball, seven, let's do seven. But my partners at Major League Baseball convinced me the market didn't want seven and we shouldn't do seven. So we developed it as four. And the truth is, it was very hard to get it down to 7 hours. The first rough cut was 6 hours and 25 minutes. And actually, you know, it's four television hours, which is 50 minute hours. Yeah. So it's really, we had to get to 320. There is so much story and so many stories that getting this to time was a real challenge, because there's so much to tell, and it's epic. It's a big, sweeping, sprawling saga of a team and a time and a place.
Yeah. Did you feel like you could have done 4 hours just on their social lives in 1980?
Yeah, I mean, I think at a certain point, it's like, you know, you do have to make some decisions because you're telling a story. And so, you know, what story are you going to tell that really shows how wild they were after hours with regard to alcohol? Okay, so that's one story. And what story are you going to tell about how they treated each other? Okay, well, that's a slightly different story. But you start piling those up, and at a certain point, you just feel like, I get it, they partied, you know? And so you have to make some decisions about, well, what is going to be representative of what's the best partying story? So every story had to bring something different to the table. And there are a few that, you know, that we had to leave out, and I missed them, you know, but the fact is, I missed them in the abstract. I don't miss them when I watch the film. I just sort of think, it's too bad we couldn't find a place for that great story, but there wasn't one.
Any stories that you came across that you weren't familiar with during this process that you found particularly entertaining?
Yeah, well, entertaining, the ones that came to mind were more heartrending. I wasn't familiar with, you know, at the time we all thought, okay, we know Daryl Strawberry, haunted, troubled, angry, you know, getting in fights with his own teammates. This is in 84, 85. Dwight Gooden comes along, and it's like, this guy is perfect. He comes from a great family background. This is terrific. I had no idea the depth of the trauma that Dwight Gooden went through during his childhood. And some of the stories he told about his childhood were completely new to me. The fact that his mother shot his father because Dwight told her, oh, that's where Dad sees that woman. You know, that's like, okay, yeah, that's enough to maybe traumatize a kid. And I don't, you know, I'm not a clinician, but maybe even drive you to you know, escape in drugs and alcohol. So like that was new to me. The depth of Keith Hernandez's psychodrama with his father was completely new to me. Keith Hernandez had a wonderful, loving, domineering father who, as Keith said, like the movie that he really, and he brought it up, I didn't even ask him, but the movie that for him exemplified his childhood was Fear Strikes Out, where Carl Malden plays this domineering father who is quite literally driving his son, Jimmy Pearsall, played by Tony Perkins, pre-Psycho, insane. And so, you know, that Keith Hernandez chose that movie to talk about his childhood, that was revealing to me and interesting and very, very new.
Yeah, this story is obviously, you know, very familiar to Mets fans, obviously of a specific generation, but, you know, the documentary is for a wider audience as well. What were the challenges of making this, you know, a story that, you know, baseball fans or even non-baseball fans, you know, want to consume?
Yeah, the challenge really was to stay out of the way and let this story tell itself and organize itself. The characters in this story are so good and so compelling that even if you don't know baseball, you will follow along and really enjoy it. We've been lucky enough to have a couple of public screenings, and we had one in Central Park. And a friend of mine brought a friend of his whose husband was away, and she is Irish, has no knowledge of baseball, but had nothing to do that night and said, well, I'll come for the first hour. And she stayed for both hours and loved it and came up to me afterwards. And I'm not going to do the Irish accent, but she loved it and said, it's human interest. It's human interest. I said, well, you don't know baseball. She said, it doesn't matter. The characters, you know, Strawberry, Gooden, Dykstra, Mookie, Hernandez, you know, sadly, Gary Carter is no longer with us, but we tell his story as well. It's like, those are great characters. So even if you don't know baseball or you hated the Mets, it still makes such compelling viewing. And the biggest challenge for me as a filmmaker was, in some ways, like get the Met fan out of the room. Like the Met fan in me had to take a backseat to the filmmaker who was letting the story tell itself as properly, as entertainingly, as dramatically, as compellingly, with as many surprises as possible.
Nick, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for the time. And we look forward to seeing the film on back-to-back nights on September 14th and 15th.
14th and 15th, that's right, 2 hours each night. Well, it was a pleasure talking to you, and thank you very much.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
Thanks again to Rustin and to Nick for that chat. The film debuts September 14th and 15th on ESPN. You know, Tim and I have been talking all season about Topps Project 70, and I need to mention that there are currently 3 Mets-related cards for sale through Topps Project 70. They're very cool. My favorite of the 3 is by an artist named King Saladin, and it is a full-on reimagining of Pete Alonso as this, like, berserk-looking cartoon polar bear. Obviously, he's Polar Bear Pete. He is surrounded by flames. It looks like his bat is actually just a bat-shaped flame. And it is just a very lively card and fun to look at. There are a couple more also very cool. Futura, a street art artist, reimagined Daryl Strawberry in a 1958 Topps baseball design, but with a sort of abstract and contemporary background. It kind of looks like a three-striped Mets flag with there's some World's Fair imagery on there. It's a real cool card, and I think for all Mets fans of my age, seeing the image of young Daryl Strawberry at the plate certainly conjures up some feelings. And then the last one, which is fun, is a Nolan Ryan card. It's funny, Nolan Ryan's career, I think we associate so much with the Angels and the Rangers and the Astros and not the Mets, since he really didn't have his best years there. But his most valuable baseball cards, because he did come up with the Mets, are those with the Mets. And it so happens. So the Ryan Topps Project 70 card is by New York Nico. It puts him on a recent Topps, a 2019 Topps card. But the image behind him is actually the World's Fair. And Nolan Ryan is kind of just staring out like he wants nothing of it, which is a very Nolan Ryan-ish look. I'm into the Nolan Ryan card because a Nolan Ryan rookie card was the most coveted card on my block growing up. What we did, like, baseball cards were very much our currency, and we scaled cards, which I think is a tradition some people had. The way we did it was you would line up some better cards against the wall, sort of tilted down. And then with your, we call them the scrub cards, which we kept in like a big old athletic bags, you would sort of fling them frisbee style at the nice cards. And if you knocked down the nice card, you got to keep that. So there was gambling. You would have to, you'd put up a couple of yours and your opponent would put up a couple of theirs. And you're playing to try to get their cards. It seems like a great fun way to increase your card collection. What we failed to consider in the late 1980s was that people were going to care a lot about the condition these cards were in. And the Nolan Ryan card that was on my block was probably passed down through generations, all of whom were scaling cards to trade them. And so it wound up in my house, and I believe it remains in my parents' house. But before you burglarize them, understand that there is a pinhole in Jerry Kuzman's face, which is a very unfortunate thing. I will not be retiring on my baseball card collection as I once thought I did. So if you come into a Topps Project 70 card, do try to keep it in better condition than me and my friends did when we were growing up. That's all the show we've got for today. Again, thanks to Rustin Dodd and Nick Davis for the insightful chat about the new ESPN 30 for 30 documentary. Tim Britton will be back next week. And he will be excited to hear about the last couple of weeks of New York Mets baseball. I look forward to telling him, and you can listen to it soon. Peace out.